Thank you. The first case for argument this morning is Ellis v. CCA of Tennessee. And Ms. Podelsky?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Christopher Podelsky on behalf of the appellants in this case. This Court should reverse the judgment of the District Court because the nurses presented sufficient evidence creating genuine issues of material fact on each of their claims. District Court's judgment in this case was based on a host of material and legal and factual errors that affected its decision to grant summary judgment to CCA. When viewed in the light most favorable to the nurses, as it must be at summary judgment, the evidence offered precludes the conclusion that there can be but one reasonable conclusion on each of the nurses' claims. As Your Honors are well familiar with the facts of this case, there are four issues that we presented, the first of which is a whistleblowing retaliation claim. On this claim, Indiana law protects the duty to report medical errors and misconduct by licensed practical nurses. The nurses in this case dutifully reported such errors to their supervisors at CCA, and as a result of that, they were retaliated against for such filings.
Could you help me with this, please? When I look through the record, the only written reports that I could find for the four appellants are singular reports, one for Nurse Forrest on June 6, 2005, complaining about 14 to 16 releases without examinations and the suspicion of using intake vitals, one for Nurse Frazier, now Ellis, on April 14, 2005, complaining about giving an insulin shot using a TB syringe, both of which appear to qualify as some violation under the Indiana Administrative Code. There's a report from Nurse Jones in July of 2006, which would not be covered under counts one or two, maybe count eight, which doesn't appear you've appealed, where she complained about harassment. I find none from Nurse McNeil. My plea for help goes to your organization and your brief, both here and in the district court, where you did not individually, nurse by nurse, count by count, provide the basis and the nexus for your discrimination case based on retaliation for each nurse. I can't see that you provided any at all for Nurse McNeil or Jones, and the nexus for those that filed the one report certainly seems hard to come by. So when you talk about the evidence is there, perhaps you can point to it in the record when you make that statement.
Your Honor, I think you just gave a very thorough and accurate assessment of the testimony. There's a few other reports that we cited to in our pleadings. Another was from Nurse Forrest, her Indiana Attorney General complaint filed on 12-14-05. That's LA 187.
She testified in her deposition that she never actually filed that.
Well, there's conflicting testimony on that point, Your Honor. The district court actually did find that she did file it, and also there was conflicting evidence. She said that she filed it at one point. At a different point, she said she didn't.
We give a de novo review.
Right.
And so we have to look not to what the district court found, but the evidence. And the evidence in her deposition was that she didn't file that report. No, well, we're not to believe her?
Well, there's some evidence saying that, but then there's other evidence saying directly that she did, Your Honor. And it's not this court's or the district court's duty at summary judgment to resolve conflicting testimony and conflicting evidence. It's exactly the province of a finder of fact to do at trial. And so in a situation such as the one you've isolated, when there is conflicting evidence, it's at summary judgment viewed in the light most favorable to the nurses. There are some other reports from Nurse Ellis that the most significant of which was on July 28th of 05 regarding Nurse Gonzalez, where Nurse Ellis observed Nurse Gonzalez giving inmates insulin through a TB syringe. The calibrations on those needles are different. That was the report for which she was suspended for 3 days. And we believe certainly that that would be a retaliatory action under the whistleblowing laws and as well under the disparate impact law. Nurse Ellis also filed a complaint on 3105 LA 113, where she wrote up that other nurses had left pills in a cup, and there were pills that were crushed by another nurse left in the cup.
Well, even if we agree with you that all these reports were protected, you still have to show the plaintiff was terminated or had employment-related benefits withheld because they made the report. And this change in shift policy seems to be a response to the tension amongst the shifts, not because of any reports were made. So what's the best evidence you have that the benefits were held because of the reports?
I think Your Honor is referring to the specific language of the statute. And,
right.
And there's multiple areas, I think, that would qualify under the statute, the first of which is the section discussing the word dismissed. And so we believe under our constructive discharge claim that would qualify as well, for example.
No. What I want to know is what's the evidence in the record that the benefits were withheld because they made the reports? You know, the evidence seems to suggest that it was the change in shift policy occurred because there was discontent amongst the nurses' staff. So what the supervisor did was put everybody on the same kind of rotation for hours in order to try to be fair. How do you tie that to?
Well, if Your Honor, if I can, I can answer your question by discussing the specific provisions of the statute under which we believe the arguments fall. It's not only the one that you identify is what the point I was trying to make. Under 22533, for example, it's not just employee benefits being withheld. It's also subsection 1 also discusses dismissal, which is our constructive discharge claim. Subsection 3 refers to reassignment, which we believe is also affected by the change in schedule issue. But to answer your question specifically about benefits withheld, I'm not sure that provision, that part of the statute, subpart 2, is what we would cite to for the shift change. We think the shift change would be more appropriate under the third subsection, which is reassignment. And all three of those things, benefits, reassignment, and dismissal, are things that are covered by this statute. I do want to point out that this is not something that was raised by CCA below or addressed by the district court. And so we have not had a chance to brief the issue of specifically what subsections of the statute we're referring to, but the reasons I just gave are the reasons we would cite to. With regard to the shift schedule change, that's primarily used in the disparate impact and the hostile work environment claims as evidence of a racial motive in changing their work schedules.
And so what's the evidence of the racial motive?
Well, there's evidence in the record, Your Honor, that the supervisor at the time, Ms. Gardner, decided to do so because there were allegations that the first shift nurses, and the evidence shows that 6 out of the 7 or 6 out of the 8 were African-American nurses, that those nurses had, the language uses, were racist towards non-African-American nurses. And so Ms. Gardner instituted a policy to break up, so to speak, the first shift nurses, 6 of the 7 being African-American. And so our argument is under Raytheon, a Supreme Court case, that motive is important in assessing disparate impact claims. And we point to that evidence of Ms. Gardner basing her shift schedule change on the fact that there was racial animus and tension between the nurse shifts. Not only that, but the shifts themselves, I think it was Nurse Ellis, with regard to the second shift change, Nurse Ellis applied for and was denied a transfer to the night shift, to the day shift from the night shift. Her supervisor assigned her to the night shift, and she went to Mr. Copeland and said, I can't do this. I'm a single mother. I have a child at home, and I can't work and provide for the child and care for the child at the same time. There's a Supreme Court quote that's quite helpful to us from Burlington, saying that it's a contextual circumstance and it's plaintiff by plaintiff, and it's not a broad characterization with regard to shift schedules. And so it's our argument, at least with regard to Nurse Ellis, that she's presented sufficient evidence on her claim that she was denied a shift change on the basis of her race.
Mary Gardner was African American, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And her position is that it was to reduce tension, to spread experience amongst the shifts, and that part of the reason that there were tensions was because different ships believe they were working harder or might be favored by management.
There's some of that as well. There are different there were different reasons that she cited, but one of them, there is an allegation that she told one of the nurses that it was because of racial animus as well. So there are other reasons as well. And when and it's our contention that when things are referred to as making things equal, that's exactly what we're talking about here. These are Nurse Forrest, for example, had been employed since 1999, the most experienced nurse, and her shift, along with other nurses, was forced to change under the new schedule. Simply because you have a neutral policy doesn't preclude it and insulate it from a disparate treatment analysis. The fact that Ms. Gardner was African American also does not affect the equation. There is case law. I don't have any for you at this time, but I have seen case law suggesting that it's the actual impact and effect that's important, not who's doing it. There are actual cases out there where African American supervisors discriminated against African Americans more than white Caucasians, and there was liability was found in those instances. It's the effect and the impact and the motive, all of those things combined, that's relevant, not the race of the supervisor. I will point out in other instances, though, the primary supervisors were Caucasian in this case. The HSA administrator, it's called, the person who is in charge of the nurses and the medical facilities, were Caucasian, and all of the other allegations in this case were instituted, the disciplinary actions, I should say, were instituted by those two individuals. The hostile work environment claim and the disparate impact claim, the district court made some material errors of law and fact, which are advanced as well by CCA in this case. The primary mistake that the party that CCA makes and the district court made with the hostile work environment claim is viewing all of the incidents in isolation rather than in totality. And it's very difficult to point to a particular case having similar factual circumstances because each case is different. But it's important to note that the totality is what's important under this court's legal precedents. And in this case, the district court and CCA examines each in a vacuum, saying, well, this incident isn't enough, this incident isn't enough. But the true test is the totality of the circumstances. And at summary judgment, the inferences are to be drawn in the nurse's favor. And we believe that we presented sufficient evidence of a collective action taken by CCA to cause a hostile work environment. The other error made by CCA throughout its briefs is pointing to what I can only call a red herring of speculation and hearsay. It's something that the district court bought in that case, in this case, and we believe that we presented sufficient evidence of direct perceptible events. We have deposition testimony from the nurses. We have the actual reports themselves that we discussed earlier in this case, and we believe that that evidence is sufficient. The allegations such as Nurse Ellis's suspension, 3-day suspension, there's no hearsay involved in that. There's no speculation. She has deposition testimony in the record clearly describing what happened to her in that situation. There's evidence from the nurses describing the monkey management sketches and the other racial incidents. The Confederate flag was observed directly on CCA employees, and in each of those instances did not involve anything to do with hearsay or speculation. And CCA made this argument below, the district court bought it, and I urge this court not to adopt it on appeal. If your honors do not have any other questions, I'd be happy to reserve my remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Podolsky.
Thank you.
Ms. Koenig.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, John Koenig with Barnes & Thornburg on behalf of CCA. Let me address the questions that Your Honors have raised this morning. First, the de novo review question, obviously that's accurate. We believe that the district court misconstrued the facts on that point. There is no conflict in the testimony or in the evidence regarding Nurse Forrest and this alleged attorney general opinion. Page 10 of the of our brief on appeal sets forth the testimony verbatim from Nurse Forrest, and she simply says, I didn't do it, in essence. She chose to go to the EEOC instead and never filed it with the Attorney General. So I'm not aware of any conflicting evidence that says that she went ahead and filed that, so I would agree with Your Honor that she never did engage in any protected activity there. Secondly, regarding the question of nexus, that was a large focus of our briefing on summary judgment. We argued extensively that there was no link between the events about which the plaintiffs complain and any actions taken against them or any sort of discipline or other sorts of things that the employer may have engaged in. We argued extensively about that there was no connection, no nexus. So we did address that in the trial court below and believe that the trial court answered that question correctly, that there was no sign of employer liability there. Thirdly, the shift rotation policy. This is the second case in which that implementation of that policy has been addressed, as is indicated in the briefing. Nurse Forrest had filed her own lawsuit prior to this. The same district court judge unfortunately drew both cases, I suppose, but they concluded in that case as well that the shift rotation policy was not discriminatory. Ms. Garner, who is African-American, implemented it in part, as Your Honor pointed out, to balance the experience on the shifts. There had been some tension about people leaving work over on the night shift for the morning shift and things like that. So to resolve it, she implemented this policy, and the district court has now found twice that the policy applied to all the employees. It didn't single out the African-American employees. It affected Caucasian employees as well as African-American employees. There was simply no evidence of discrimination there. The next argument raised the totality of the circumstances. CCA respectfully posits that the plain language of the district court's opinion shows the court handled that correctly. The court considered the allegations together and just concluded that it was not in totality evidence of a hostile environment or that would support constructive discharge. Looking at the language that the court used on page 28 of the summary judgment opinion, it's plain that the court noted that it was considering the totality of the circumstances and concluded, quote, the allegations do not individually or together establish a legally cognizable hostile environment. We believe that is a non-issue here on appeal. The court followed the proper standard. And the last argument regarding something that we tried to sell to the district court and that the district court bought it, respectfully, the district court has given a very thorough analysis of the facts. The district court applied long established, well-settled principles of law endorsed by this court regarding the severity of that's necessary to show a hostile environment. The court went through each of the facts alleged, construed those in the favor of the plaintiff, and concluded at the end that the evidence did not establish a hostile environment. CCA did not sell anything to the court, and the court certainly didn't buy it. It applied well-settled authority to reach the conclusions. Regarding the statutory whistleblower claim, Your Honors, the plaintiff simply did not allege a violation of any law. The statute's very plain on its face that they have to report in writing a violation of law. That never happened and still hasn't happened as of today.
The plaintiff did allege a violation of the administrative code. You argued that code doesn't apply to your client. Help me with understanding why you believe that to be the case.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Two things there. The administrative code provision, when read, regards unprofessional conduct of a licensed practical nurse. Obviously, CCA is a corporate entity, is not a licensed practical nurse, and is not subject to that administrative regulation. Beyond that, CCA has argued that that administrative regulation was not violated in any event. The regulation on its face says that a licensed practical nurse shall report alleged unprofessional conduct to the appropriate party. An appropriate party can include that person's employer. And all the plaintiffs in this case admitted they did exactly what that regulation required, reported it to CCA. So therefore, they were not subject to any liability under that administrative regulation. So it's kind of a circular argument that plaintiffs are making that somehow there could be a violation of the law through this regulation, even though They themselves testified that the regulation wasn't violated. The fact remains, under the statute, they have to prove that they reported a violation of law. They did not prove that that statute was violated. There was no violation of the law. None of the nurses were ever disciplined. There was simply no potential culpability on their part. They exhausted their obligations by reporting it to CCA.
Is it a multi-step process? So, for example, if a nurse sees an unprofessional act, reports it to the employer, nothing's done, then reports it to the Attorney General, but that wasn't pled.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part.
Okay. So the unprofessional conduct takes place. Another nurse reports that to the employer, says nurse so-and-so didn't do something required by the professional code or professional requirements. Employer does nothing about that. Then the next step under the law, not the code, the law, is to then report that to the Attorney General or the board, the State Board of Regulation. But that's not what we have pled in this case.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the facts, as I indicated earlier, the only allegation about a report to an outside entity was Nurse Forrest, and we've already established that her own direct testimony confirmed that she never filed that with the Attorney General. So, yes, that was part of our argument below, that the statute requires reports to outside entities, the Attorney General or others identified in the statute. That never happened here. And beyond that, the facts showed that the CCA, who has a doctor on staff, and they've got a doctor that he reports to, and they have professionals that run the medical department, concluded that there were not that the complaints didn't have merit. They believe that CCA was handling things appropriately. The only other aspect of that plaintiffs have alleged is just that somehow there was an obligation on somebody's part to report medication errors, is what they've called them. They've never identified any obligation that flows from the law. The evidence that CCA submitted at the trial court was that they're not aware of any obligation to do that. So, Your Honor is correct that they did not report these things outside. Regarding the race discrimination claims, we covered the shift rotation policy again. That was implemented way back in 2005. We argued that plaintiffs did not establish an adverse employment action. On the shift rotation policy, the evidence was, in fact, that the nurses got paid more to work on an evening shift. This court has in the Grube decision, rejected a change in shift as constituting an adverse employment action. The same argument was made by Ms. Forrest in the first case about this impact on her personal life. Again, this court in the Grube case and the Griffin case rejected just that same argument. The court did that as well in the first Forrest case. There were a couple other items that plaintiffs argued about regarding, for example, a lunch break. That evidence involves two plaintiffs who are no longer parties to the present matter. They didn't appeal. And the evidence just showed that the CCA didn't want to shut down the particular function they were performing in the medical department so they could both go to lunch together. And certainly that wasn't a significant, tangible employment action to ask them to split up their lunch. The similarly situated prong, the CCA feels very strong that the court correctly found that CCA did not select these African-American nurses for mistreatment. CCA has terminated Caucasian nurses for making medication errors, for example. Some of these plaintiffs admitted making medication errors. They were not terminated. There was certainly ample evidence in the district court that the same supervisor involved with the plaintiffs disciplined Caucasian nurses as well. And the court correctly construed the burden on the constructive discharge, that's a higher standard than to prove a hostile environment. In fact, the court cited a case, the Whitaker versus the Whitaker versus Northern Illinois University case, and Judge Williams authored that opinion. The standard there is that the threshold for plaintiffs is high. The workplace that is actionable is one that is hellish. It's a stringent standard to meet the hostile work environment standard. So that conclusion that the district court drew was certainly supported by the evidence.
Let me ask you about Nurse Forrest's claims, because she had filed her own suit against the CCA toward the end of November in 05, right? And then she amended the complaint, and at some point she joined the present lawsuit. Some of the incidents she points to arose after she filed suit, right? Are there any incidents, because as I read it, some of them fell after that, so res judicata wouldn't apply at least to those specific things that occurred after the lawsuit was filed?
Well, there's the record is, I think that allegation was made. I'm not certain that plaintiffs or through Ms. Forrest ever identified any specific tangible action that happened to her after she filed the original lawsuit. And certainly the district court concluded, we believe correctly, that the factual basis was already established before she filed the first lawsuit to raise any of the claims that she wanted to raise, particularly the whistleblower claim. Appellant's counsel discussed this TB syringe incident. Nurse Forrest made those allegations in the first lawsuit. She didn't bring a specific whistleblower claim, but the factual basis was there. She had reported the TB syringe incident and all the other items. She just chose not to do it. The case law in the circuit is very, very clear that she could have brought those claims the first time around, and because she could have brought those claims, they're covered by res judicata. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Koenig, Mr. Podolsky.
Your Honors, just a few quick points on rebuttal. The evidence about conflicting testimony with regard to Nurse Forrest's AG opinion, I point Your Honors to LA 137 of the record, where she says, quote, "And that's why I quoted you that Indiana statute thing, because I had filed a complaint with the Attorney General." That conflicts with the quote that we just heard from Capella's counsel. And at summary judgment, any conflicts in testimony are to be resolved by the fact finder, not by the court at summary judgment. The second point.
That's a conflict by the same speaker.
That's correct, Your Honor.
What's your authority for a district judge having to not accept one statement over the other?
I don't have a specific case.
This is not two people viewing the same event, right, Ms. Podolsky? It's
certainly,
it's
Your Honor.
Conflicting testimony by the one individual.
It is a different situation. I don't have a case for you. I'd be happy to provide one to the court. The argument is that the inquiry at summary judgment is looking at the evidence.
Is your argument with Nurse Forrest that she was confused? What will be your, if this were to go forward, what will be the position on that critical point?
The position would be that she did file it. I believe that she was confused at that deposition where she said she was, if you look at the context, I don't have that specific part of the record pulled up at the moment, but I do believe if you look at the questioning, there is some confusion, some back and forth between the attorney, CCA's counsel, and her on that issue. On this question, you know, on this point, she says quite clearly, I did file it. I filed it with the Attorney General. I think that's pretty clear.
Yeah, but it was never found. There was no documentation to corroborate her on that.
Well, we did attach to in the limited appendix. There is the actual complaint itself. We don't have a file stamp copy from.
Right, that's what I'm talking about.
And
something that shows the Attorney General got it.
Yeah, and I don't believe that that's in the record, but she does have her deposition testimony, which corroborates the actual report that's attached. At summary judgment, you know, her deposition testimony and that combined should be sufficient. Again, you don't have to conclusively prove a summary judgment that was the case. You just need evidence to support a reasonable fact finder to conclude that it was, and we believe that was the case. On the whistleblower claim,
you don't see a distinction between having something timestamped from the Attorney General versus just something that could, I mean, it's just there. It doesn't show
I think,
because that's what's critical, at least in my view.
I understand, Your Honor, and I think that that's a question of weight to the evidence. I think that if someone says, I filed something and they attach it as summary judgment in a deposition, if they say that, I think that that's sufficient evidence, and then it's up to court, or up to the fact finder to decide what weight to give that evidence. If there's a contradiction in somewhere else with the deposition, if it's not file stamped, I think that goes to weight, not to relevance or admissibility in the first instance, which we believe is sufficient.
I apologize. What did you say the conflicting statement was? What's the source?
It's LA 137, Your Honor. And she says, that's why I quoted you that Indiana statute thing, because I did file.
I understand that, but what is that you're reading? Is it an affidavit?
This is a deposition. This is part of her deposition. This is the 228-06 deposition.
So later in the deposition, she said that she did file it?
That may be a better question for Mr. Koenig, who took the deposition. I believe that this is a different incident. I could be wrong.
Well, different deposition?
I believe so. She did have two depositions.
I see. Okay, I apologize. I didn't catch that. All right.
Okay. Judge Herndon, I did want to address your question. I believe, just to clarify, that there is no requirement to report directly to an outside entity in 22533, the Indiana statute involved. The statute itself says that the report must be first to the private employer, unless the private employer is the person whom the employee believes is committing the violation. In that case, the employee may report the violation to either the private employer or to an official of an outside agency. So there's no requirement that all these reports that were filed had to be filed to an outside agency.
Well, I kind of understood that, but if you always report to the employer and the employer never does anything, you would just leave it at that? You would never do anything else?
If I understand the hypothetical, if an employee reports a medical error to the employer and the employer doesn't do anything, well, in that case, there's certainly no claim. There has to be retaliatory action. So that's step one, is reporting to the employer. Step two is retaliatory action. And so I just want to clarify that I thought that CCA was arguing that you were required to report the outside entity, and that's simply not the case under the statute. It's to the private employer. And I'm quite surprised that CCA continues to say that they're not responsible and that its nurses that it employs have no duty under the Indiana Code to report medical errors. It's quite clear under those provisions that they do have duties to report such errors and that they have an obligation to do so.
The statute says may. The code says shall.
That's correct, Your Honor. The code compels nurses to report medical errors and penalizes them if they do not. The statutory provision says that a nurse may file a complaint. It's a permissive thing. The nurse isn't required to file a complaint under the statute, but those two things working in conjunction, when a nurse does file a complaint that is required under law, then the statute's triggered, and that's what we argue happened in this instance. I do see that my time is up, Your Honors, if you have any additional questions. Otherwise, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Elsie. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.